I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Coming up, I'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter James Steele, who with his writing partner Donald Barlett sounded the alarm 30 years ago about the pernicious effects of the wealth gap on the middle class. Their new book, America, What Went Wrong? The Crisis Deepens, updates their original reporting and offers a series of bold reforms. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy wants to reduce the wealth gap in his state. He included a baby bonds initiative in his new budget last week, earmarking $1,000 for most newborns to be invested and given to them when they turn 18.
When so many families are struggling with how they will pay their bills or seeing their hard-earned savings disappear, let's make a better promise to the next generation of New Jerseyans. This investment will provide tens of thousands of future New Jerseyans with hope for a better life starting on day one of their own life.
The baby bonds proposal could cost the state an estimated $80 million, and the return by most estimates would be modest. We asked Joe Hernandez, WHYY's New Jersey reporter, to join us and explain. And Joe, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Well, let's begin with a really basic question. What are baby bonds?
Yeah, so we could even start with what is a bond. So a bond is like a financial instrument that you buy for a fixed cost, and then you can't access it for a number of years, like a decade or two, and it's gaining interest over that time. And then after the period is up, you can take it out, and it's high a little bit, you know, it costs a little bit more than when you first paid for it. A baby bond is, in this case, the state is buying bonds on behalf of babies being born next year. It's investing that money, and then 18 years later, those babies, when they become adults, can take out the bonds, and they're a little bit, they're going to be have a little bit more money than when the state first bought them.
I was reading several articles about this, including yours, Joe, and it seems. Oops, I'm getting a spam call on my phone here. Oh, well, that the return is modest. It's a one-time investment of $1,000, What is the return based on what you've been able to figure out?
Well, the New York Times estimated, they used current interest rates and estimated that a $1,000 baby bond purchased next year could be worth $1,270 in 18 years. And that obviously, that could range a little bit, probably below $2,000. So the return on the individual bond itself may be modest, but it could have a large impact on the life of the, you know, the person who gets it.
Has the governor been talking about this before? Was this a surprise, or is this something he's been touting in the state?
I think the specific proposal was a bit of a surprise. Murphy hadn't proposed this before, but he has often talked about, I mean, one of the main things he talks about when he talks about budgeting and state finances is having the wealthier residents pay their fair share in taxes and growing the middle class, giving opportunities to those who are, you know, have lower incomes, who are struggling, giving them opportunities to get into the middle class, to go to college, to buy a house, things like that. So this is definitely in line with his ideology, but the specific proposal, I think, was a surprise to some people.
And do we know the wealth gap in New Jersey, how large it is?
The wealth gap, I mean, New Jersey has among the highest wealth gaps among states in the country, not the highest, but it's up there, and it's been growing. And the pandemic has only made things worse. I mean, New Jersey has a record number of people applying for unemployment benefits over the past couple months, and the pandemic has disproportionately affected people, you know, Black people, Latino people, the most harshly.
Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation talking at the top of the hour here with Joe Hernandez, New Jersey reporter for WHYY, talking about Governor Murphy's baby bonds idea. And if you're in New Jersey, we particularly want to hear from you, what you think of this, what you make of this. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joe, as it stands now, and my understanding, too, is that there's not a whole lot of detail in this baby bonds idea, but who would it apply for, or who would it apply to?
Sure. So right now it's part of the budget that Murphy proposed for next year, and it would apply to any babies born in the year 2021 into families making less than $131,000, roughly, and that's about 500% of the poverty level. And the state estimates that that would be about 72,000 children next year.
Is that half of the state, a third of the state, most of the state?
I think it's about three quarters of the estimated children born next year. I would have to check that, but it's a lot because the New Jersey tends to be an expensive state to live in, and right. as we mentioned earlier, the wealth gap there is quite large.
It's interesting. I remember Cory Booker, the senator from New Jersey, talking about baby bonds when he was running for president. Was Murphy in any way, do you think, influenced by Senator Booker?
Yeah, he actually mentioned in his proposal that this was first floated by Senator Booker during his presidential campaign. The Booker proposal is a little bit different. I think it had to do with the federal government, first of all, and the government would also continue to invest in kind of like an account for children as they grew up. This proposal is a one-time purchase of a $1,000 bond when the child is born. It gains interest over 18 years, and then they can take it out when they're age 18.
And can they spend it on anything, or is it for very specific kinds of costs or purchases?
Yeah, it can't be spent on anything. The purpose, it's restricted to what the state is calling wealth-generating activities. So that's things like buying a home, going to college, starting a business. And the point of that, I think, is because this proposal, you know, the goal of the proposal is to close the wealth gap. There are a lack of opportunities for people who don't have capital when they turn 18. They might continue to be a renter because they can't afford a down payment on a house, for example. So the state is restricting what it can be used for to things that would help people advance, give them those opportunities to climb the ladder.
Again, and not to diminish what the governor is trying to do, but if you have $1,200 or $1,300, I mean, maybe that would help to put a down payment on a house. But it seems, especially in New Jersey, that the cost of a house is going to far outstrip that.
Right. I mean, you know, remember the baby doesn't have to put in the $1,000 either. So although the rate of return is low, this is just, this is $1,200 that the sure. family didn't have before, didn't put down in the first place. And, the wealth gap described by experts is such that, you know, it's not falling exactly on racial lines, but generally white families tend to have more wealth than Black and Latino families. And that wealth is passed down through the generations. So a white person, teenager who turns 18, who might want to go to college but can't afford it because of the, you know, lowish paying job they have, might have parents who can give them some money to get started. But a Black or Latino student might not have that money, and that money could be just a small amount to get started. And that's, I think, what this is aimed at.
What's been the response from the legislature, from Republicans and Democrats in New Jersey?
Yeah, there's been some pushback from Republicans along the lines of, you know, New Jersey right now is cash strapped like every other state because of the pandemic. And this would be a new expense as opposed to just cutting expenses, which is what some lawmakers believe the state should do, cut expenses and lower taxes so people can recover from the pandemic. Democrats, we haven't heard as much from yet as far as whether they would definitely support the proposal or not. And in New Jersey, Democrats control both houses of the legislature. So we'll have to wait and see what they think about this. But Murphy will have to convince them, get the support of Democrats in order to get this across the goal line.
When do you think the legislature is going to begin to discuss and debate this?
Well, budget hearings start next week on Murphy's proposed budget. The state moved its fiscal year back 3 months to deal with the pandemic. So just last week, Murphy proposed a budget that would take the state from the fall through the beginning of next summer. This is a 9-month budget that's over $30 billion, and this is part of that budget. And so the legislative hearings on that start next week. So I'm not sure when it's going to come up in those hearings, but it could happen as early as next Tuesday.
as you said, part of this $32 billion budget, which does call for cuts for borrowing and also for higher taxes, correct?
Correct. It's got over $1 billion in cuts to state departments, but it also has Murphy wants to borrow $4 billion for pandemic-related expenses. That's been another criticism from Republicans, that these babies who get $1,200 check when they turn 18 are going to, if they stay in New Jersey, have to pay off that $4 billion in debt for, you know, the next three, four decades. But the budget also includes a hike in the millionaire's tax. This is something that Murphy has been pushing for, a higher income tax rate for people making over $1 million. Democrats in the legislature have been somewhat resistant to this, but I think the millionaire's tax and the baby bonds initiative kind of go hand in hand. They're part of Murphy's thinking about having wealthier people like him pay their fair share in taxes and give opportunities to those who have less to get into the middle class to advance and buy that house or go to college.
Joe, let me read a couple of comments. One from Phil, he says, I realize the moral hazard in investing in equities, but why not consider a passive index fund? We'll just let the governor and other people to figure out the best way to invest that money. A comment from Kate, how is anybody going to use $1,200 to pay the extremely high property taxes in New Jersey? Why not do something about that? Then a comment from Casey, wouldn't mandating personal financial education, budgeting, et cetera, go much further to close the wealth gap than handing out a nominal one-time gift, which raises the question, and maybe it's too soon to know, how the public in New Jersey is feeling about this baby bonds idea.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear. It sounds like we got a bit of a taste of it in those comments. There hasn't been any polling on this yet as far as the public is concerned, so I don't know the answer to that. As far as the property tax question goes, I think that's a fair point. Democrats and Republicans have been pushing Murphy to deal with property taxes in a more holistic way. As far as the question about financial education goes, I think that the thinking is not that people who would be receiving these bonds are irresponsible with money, just that they don't have the opportunities through generational, you know, wealth giving that some people in higher income brackets do have.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Joe Hernandez, as always, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's WHYY's New Jersey reporter, giving us a bit of an explanation on Governor Murphy's baby bonds idea in New Jersey. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be joined by Pulitzer Prize winning journalist James Steele, and we'll be talking more about the income gap or the wealth gap and his book written with Donald Barlett 30 years ago, America, What Went Wrong, has a new title, The Crisis Deepens. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were just talking about New Jersey Governor Murphy's baby bonds proposal to try to narrow the wealth gap in the Garden State. Our guest James Steele and his writing partner Donald Barlett have been sounding the alarm about the wealth gap for decades, beginning when they were investigative journalists at the Philadelphia Inquirer. America, What Went Wrong was their groundbreaking series published by the paper in 1992 and turned into a book. They were guests on Radio Times back then to talk about their findings based on years of painstaking research and heartfelt interviews. Well, they've updated their book, adding The Crisis Deepens to the title, and have found that income inequality has only worsened. For instance, between 1992 and 2017, the average income for the 1%, the wealthiest of the wealthy, increased 238%, while average middle-class incomes increased by just 17% in those years. Joining us by Skype is James Steele. He and Donald won two Pulitzer Prizes and many other awards for their reporting. And Jim Steele, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Very good to be with you, Marty.
Let me make sure our listeners can join our conversation. I just want to give out the ways that you can do that. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Jim, was there ever a golden age for the middle class in this country?
There was. After World War II, really well into the 1970s, middle-class incomes went up, pensions, which was the way a lot of middle-class people looked forward to retiring, increased, and the percentage increase in earnings between those at the very top and the middle class proceeded at roughly the same sort of percentage rate. I mean, we're always going to have rich people, nothing wrong with that, that's fine. But at that time, you had everybody was part of the equation. Everybody prospered. Everything went. And one of the most remarkable statistics that we talked about 30 years ago, which we updated in the new book, is that CEO pay. Back in the 60s, a famous guru of business by the name of Peter Drucker felt that the ideal ratio between what CEOs, corporate executives paid versus what those on the factory floor or in the floor of the department store, whatever the other business was, what that ratio was 20 to 1 for every dollar somebody on in the ranks made, the executive would make 20 times that. Well, when we did the original What Went Wrong back in the early 90s, that had soared to 89 to 1. And everybody just gasped at that when that number came out. Well, today it's more than 300 to 1.
Wow.
So we have this wealth gap. We see it at the CEO ranks. You see it in other aspects of the society. And you go back to that golden age. One of the reasons that age was there was that the government did programs, enacted programs that helped everybody. You had the GI Bill after World War II. You had the Federal Housing Administration programs. You had the Interstate Highway Program in the 50s. It created a lot of jobs, not just construction jobs, but all kinds of spillover jobs that something, a project of that size created. So the point being, the government enacted certain things that benefited the population as a whole. And that's the big difference today.
Sure. And let me pick up on several things there. One thing that you and Donald write in the book is that our tax system is the greatest driver of income inequality. So picking up on that and looking at then what happened from the 50s and even into the 60s to today, with a stopping off point in the 1990s. So what was it or is it about our tax system that drives this income inequality? And is it we look at the stock market, you know, and how you make money on the stock market, and we treat it very differently from how we treat someone who makes their living, their salary, on strictly wages?
I couldn't help reacting to the report earlier in the program about how the stock market is up today, but yet the jobs report is down. It's like, it's typical of these
what
two
is economies. That? I'm one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is to try to understand that.
Well, it's typical of the two economies. The people who invest in stock have many more options available to them. And of course, the Federal Reserve has been helping bolster the stock market as well. But in the jobs report showing that things are softening again, that's the point we make in the book. When even before COVID-19, things were not quite as rosy for most Americans as folks in Washington would have us believe. Yes, unemployment was down. Mm-hmm. But in that figure of like 3.5% unemployment at the time, one of the missing ingredients in terms of what people understood was a lot of people were working two jobs. So, yeah, unemployment was down, but people aren't making that much money. And that's the thing you see over and over again. Wages have stagnated. Median family income has not kept pace with things. And that's, in our view, it's because we have depended too much on what I would call the private market. We haven't really invested in the society as a whole. And that's actually one of the reasons the crisis in our mind is so severe. And we make the point, most of this book was actually updated and expanded really before COVID came along. We amended it just as that was happening, because it's a perfect example, our failure with COVID, to have any kind of a national response to a national emergency. The same kind of national emergency is out there in terms of jobs, benefits, retirement, those things affecting working people in the middle class. And, you know, that's something once we get beyond COVID, we're really going to have to face as well.
And I do want to talk to you about all of that. Let me go back to the stock market. And yes, that's where a lot of wealthy people have their money, but it's also where 401ks are invested. So, and I'm sure you've heard this argument before, which is, while it does benefit those people that can use capital gains to their advantage, there are people invested who are middle class people invested in the stock market. How true is that?
That is certainly true. I mean, 401ks, of course, have been the replacement for pensions. And in general, for the vast majority of people, they do not measure up to what pensions did. But yes, if you've been lucky enough to put money into your 401k over time, and if your employer has also supplemented that as well, that's good. But the key thing is when you look at the numbers overall, and one of the numbers that just jumped out to us when we did the update, you look at people in their retirement years, let's say folks 60 to 69 years old, the average amount of money, the median amount of money in 401k accounts, people in approaching retirement, is roughly $60,000.
Wow.
I mean, that's going to yield an income of roughly $3,000 a year. So yes, some of those people are invested in the stock market and they benefit from whatever small earnings they get from that. But it is not a solution for the vast majority of people. And that's our point. Yes, many people are doing well in this country, many people at the top. But increasingly, the vast majority of Americans aren't. One image I will never get out of my mind after COVID hit were these lines of cars and trucks, 1 to 2 weeks after the virus hit, of people who had been laid off or furloughed, lining up for boxes of food. These weren't people rounded up under viaducts, homeless folks who had nowhere to go. These were working people, men and women, who'd suddenly been tossed out. And what did that say? It said they had no safety net. They had no savings. Because they were not making enough money, they didn't have a way to get through that particular period. And that's true. You just see this over and over again in the studies of what people have to live on. And people are right up against the wall economically. Because their incomes have not kept pace and their costs, healthcare and other things, have gone up.
Well, just picking up on that, I don't have the exact number, but I remember reading about a substantial portion of the population has, you know, only $400 in the bank. So if there's an emergency of $500 or $600, they cannot cover that because they literally don't have the money. Also, the fact that the federal government was able to, at least for several months, give people $600 a week to get them through the worst of this pandemic, or through the, you know, the pandemic of a couple of months ago, still with us, obviously, but the money's not there. That for a number of people, that was more money than they were making at their jobs. Can you speak to that, Jim?
Well, and I'm glad you brought up the $400, because that is one of the most amazing surveys. That figure was derived from a study from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And we don't exactly associate the Federal Reserve Bank of New York with a wild leftist organization.
No,
I don't think.
Not at all.
So they're the ones who came up with the study that showed 4 out of 10 Americans, if faced with an emergency, don't have $400 in any way. So, I mean, that tells you people are right up against the edge. And the initial outlays after COVID hit were really obviously beneficial to a lot of people. Of course, those things are running out now. And they desperately need some additional relief to get them through this. And what we're really worried about is that once we get beyond this, maybe once we get a vaccine, once we get back to something approximating some kind of normalcy in this country, are people going to forget the structural problems that have brought most Americans to this point, which is they're not making enough money, their healthcare costs are going up, and they're having to bear more of the brunt of those. They don't have good retirement plans in place. I mean, those are really crucial issues facing us even before the virus. And frankly, we're worried that those may get shoved aside because the virus will be over or nearly over, and people will be so happy that there's something close to normalcy.
Let me reintroduce you, and I do want to get to some of the reforms that you and Donald Barlett have identified in your book, talking with James Steele. He and his writing partner, Donald Barlett, were at the Philadelphia Inquirer for many years. In fact, guests on Radio Times talking about a lot of the research that they did looking at the income, the wealth gap in America, looking at previous decades. Their book, which was a series in the paper, out in paperback now, America, What Went Wrong, with an update, and it's has a new title, America, What Went Wrong, The Crisis Deepens, and they are Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. They've won many other awards for their reporting as well. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, you have a number of quote-unquote modest proposals here. One is to raise taxes on the wealthy on the wealthiest, and also on the largest corporations. How much do you think?
Well, I'm not sure I fully answered your question earlier about taxes and as the great driver of inequality. For the last 40 years, wealthy people have received one excellent tax break after another. A lot of young people don't realize that as recently as 1980, one of the top rates was 70% on some income.
Yeah.
Today it's 37%. And many other things have flowed to their advantage during that time. So we think to restore some balance in the system, you not only have to raise the top rate, at least several points. We don't specifically fix on one particular thing. You could make it for people over 10 million or 5 million. 1 million, you could do any of those things, but obviously that has to be raised to create some balance there. And the other major thing, though, frankly, is corporations. I mean, the Trump tax bill lowered the top rate from 35 to 21%, and that should be increased again. Another thing a lot of people don't realize, corporations used to pay roughly 40% of the total income tax bill. This year, even before COVID hit, it was going to be under 10%.
Wow.
Now, corporations derive benefits from this country. Roads, air, workforces, any number of things. I mean, there's certain great benefits to being in this country and doing your product, producing jobs, and so forth. But they need to pay a larger share of that. The Trump tax bill of 2017 was perhaps the worst of a long line of tax bills that showered gifts on the wealthy. One of the statistics we came up with is for people who making $1 million or more a year, that bill gave them an annual tax cut for the next 10 years in excess of $64,000 a year. So what sense does it make to be sending money to people who really don't need money? And in contrast to that, in the middle class, people making $50,000 to $75,000, they received on average roughly $800 a year. I mean, that's what's been wrong with the system now for really 40 years. I mean, the wealthy continue to get those kinds of tax breaks. We also computed folks at the top making $1 million or more a year. That class of people will get, over the life of the Trump tax bill, more than $500 billion in tax refunds, not refunds, but just tax breaks. That's a $500 billion that could go to any number of very, very worthy programs in the United States. So I think taxes are the first thing. That's why it's not the sole driver of inequality, sure. But in our book, it is the single greatest one.
And let me just add to what you were saying. I'm looking at page 67, which is looking at not just the Trump tax bill, but it does focus in on that. Looking at a list of corporations, you asked, do any of these names seem familiar? The dollar figure in parentheses after each represents the amount of federal income taxes they paid in 2018. Amazon, zero. Chevron, zero. Eli Lilly, zero. General Motors, zero. Halliburton, zero. IBM, zero. Netflix, zero. Prudential, zero. Is that still true today, Jim, from what you know?
I haven't looked at the most recent one, but I'm sure some of those are still in that particular category. And if it's not them, it's going to be some others, because that's just the way the tax code works. There's enough benefits in there for corporations. One of the ones we wrote about 30 years ago that astonished people was the deduction that corporations have for interest on debt. This has become a huge driver for the whole private equity industry. And this has been a way to dismantle companies, create all kinds of mayhem in the marketplace by a lot of those PE companies. That deduction was nixed slightly in the 2017 tax bill, but essentially it's still out there. And that is one of the reasons why corporate debt is at an all-time high. And when corporate debt is at an all-time high and you have a shutdown like this, or a slowdown like we're having economically, among the first people who get axed in something like that are workers and employees. So the companies can figure out a way to handle their interest payments and so forth. So if it isn't one of those companies, it's going to be others, because the tax code.
I don't know if that's you or me.
Excuse me, folks.
I had my phone ring during the very first segment. Jim, hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a break, and I just want to read a comment from Tiara, who says she just wanted to correct your guest on his comment that the FHA and GI Bill benefited everyone in the 1950s. She says African Americans were locked out of many of those benefits, and that's, you know, there's absolutely...
Absolutely.
That's absolutely true. So thank you for that correction. Tiara, we're going to take a very short break. We'll get back to our guest, James Steele, who, along with Donald Barlett, have been writing for years now about the problem, the pernicious problem of income inequality in America. America, What Went Wrong was their series back in the 1990s. They now have a new book, an updated book, with a addendum to the title, America, What Went Wrong, The Crisis Deepens. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at phone number 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moskow.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And then you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Some 30 years ago, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Barlett and James Steele sounded the alarm about income inequality in their Philadelphia Inquirer series and their book, America, What Went Wrong. I'm talking now with Jim Steele, who is updating us on income disparity in this country, which has really only deepened in the last couple of decades, and what can be done to strengthen the middle class. Jim, let me play a clip. This is actually your co-author, Donald Barlett. It's 1992. He's on C-SPAN with you, and this was upon the release of your book, America, What Went Wrong. Let's give it a listen.
We say we're kind of short-term pessimists, but long-term optimists, and because we really believe in the American people. You can't spend 2 years crisscrossing the country talking to these people without coming away with a sense of people who really care about what's happening in the country.
Do you share that today, Jim, a kind of optimism in the American people?
I do have optimism in the American people. And I want that optimism to spread all the way to Washington. That's what I want. You can't help but not be optimistic. And in fact, one of the things that you see today, especially in the political campaign this year, the number of young people who are really calling for better health care systems, calling for increases in the minimum wage, calling for a better economic environment for young people, calling for some way to deal with the terrible student loan debt problem, which is this terrible deficits that's around the neck of so many young and not so young people, which was basically was not even there back in 1992 when we wrote the first edition of this book. So, yes, I have that kind of optimism, and in the sense that anything is possible. And you see it in America over the years. I mean, one of the things we talk about in the epilogue in the book is that there are all of the, there have been previous times in America where there were crises, economic crises, healthcare crises, people being poisoned by bad food and bad medicines. And eventually Congress in Washington reacted, but the people put enough pressure on them. We've got a similar kind of thing for Social Security in the 1930s. And to some extent, the same thing with Medicare in the 60s. If we didn't have if some of those things were done, this country would be even in worse shape. So, yes, I'm optimistic that those things can happen. And I just hope enough people come together and put enough pressure on Washington to make sure that this is what we as a nation need and want and should have.
Let me read a comment from Phil and then ask you a question. Phil says, adopt a policy of paying a living wage. Right now, we subsidize people for accepting starvation pay. Some corporations take advantage of this situation, which we all pay for. And you do call for raising the federal minimum wage and some other, I would say, work and wage related issues. Do you see an appetite for this?
Well, it's interesting on the minimum wage. The federal minimum wage hasn't been increased since 2009. And if it had gone up at the rate of inflation, it would be roughly 35% higher than it is today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a real problem. And in fact, a number of folks in Washington were pointing to look at the economy, that there's some increase in wages. This happened in states where the states had enacted minimum wages, wage levels higher than the federal level. And that's what contributed to a broader and a better economy for those states. So, yes, that's a fundamental one. I think right alongside of it, though, is the fact we need to invest in the country. It's not just infrastructure. It's certain kinds of new industries. Obviously, the Green New Deal has caught the imagination of a lot of people. Obviously, has the possibility of many jobs there. Investing in certain kinds of research facilities as well. We need to do something that moves us away from the prevailing theory of the last 40 years, which is that the private market will take care of everything. It just has. And I think COVID-19 has exposed this more dramatically than anything anybody could ever have even written about.
As you say, it hasn't, but does it want to? Does the private market want to control the rest of the economy?
The private market does want to control the rest of the economy because it means fewer regulations. It means less interference with things. But America has always been a partnership between people and corporations. And sometimes these things get out of balance. And they've been very much out of balance the last 40 years for the most part. There are a few exceptions here and there. It is amazing when you think about Obamacare, the kind of opposition this thing generated. It is the most modest attempt to deal with a social problem in America compared to something like Medicare, let's say, for example. And yet you would have thought the country was marching down the road to the darkest form of communism and socialism. I mean, ridiculous stuff like that. But it shows you how strong some feelings are in this country. But we need to do something a lot more than Obamacare. We need to figure out a way to bring people who don't have health insurance into the system. We need to figure out a way to help people who do have health insurance pay for a lot of the charges that have been now being put on their backs. So there's a huge need for that out there, and it will depend on who goes to Washington next year, and not just in the White House, but certainly in both houses of Congress.
Let's get a couple of callers in on the conversation. It looks like we've got Match calling us from New Jersey. And Match, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I just want to first say, pray he's resting in peace. I'm speaking about Herman Cain. I was wondering, would the idea that he had as far as 999, not so much on that, with those numbers, would that have had any better effect on a person level of the economy as far as what they got paid or whatever? That's my question.
Okay, fair. Yeah, fair enough. Thanks for calling in. Have you thought about that, Jim?
Well, I didn't catch the beginning of that. Is he saying the money that went to the rich, if that went somewhere else, would that have an effect on the economy?
Remember when Herman Cain was running for president and he had this 999 plan? I think the idea is just I kind of forget all the details, but just, you know, I guess instead of these different rates all over the place, it's just 999. Would that fix what we're talking about?
I think this is the flat tax idea roughly. And I've always felt the flat tax was a bad idea because it sounds simple. But the fact of the matter is, it's a tremendous boon to folks at the very top. They get a huge tax cut. And in our mind, what's created so much of the income inequality is the fact they've been getting tax cuts all along, far in excess of that particular item. You'll hear other people say, well, let's have a national sales tax. Well, nothing would be more harmful to the middle class working people than a national sales tax in terms of taking money away from them. So the income tax, the personal income tax is actually, nobody loves it, likes it, and so forth. Who likes to pay your taxes? I mean, nobody does, of course. Sure. But it's still the best and most equitable way, in our mind, of raising money to pay for things, the government, and so forth. So I think we can operate within that system, but just make it fairer in terms of most people.
Let me ask you about something that President Trump wants to permanently make cuts to the payroll tax without getting into a lot of the details. But you describe the payroll tax as really regressive and burdensome for middle class taxpayers. But the concern is if you don't get the money into the system, then you don't have your Social Security or your Medicare. Is there a solution to addressing what you see as some of the inequities in how we pay for these programs?
He's talking about a different aspect of the payroll tax than we are. A lot of working people basically don't even pay much in federal income taxes, but they do pay the payroll tax because, as you point out, that is Social Security and Medicare. The inequity in our mind is the fact that at a certain point, if you're wealthy, you just don't pay those taxes. And that's where, in our mind, that should go all the way on. That should go all the way on up, no matter how much you make. And that would make it fairer than the current system. And that might even let you then reduce the rate for some people at lower ends of the scale. But nobody wants to talk about that. I mean, during the Obama administration, after the Great Recession of 2008, the payroll tax was suspended for a while. So there is a precedent for that from time to time. But what we would like to see would be that whole issue looked at in some depth and taxes increased for those at the top who can afford it and perhaps reduced a little bit for those at the lower end for whom it is a burden very often.
Let me get Mike from Germantown to join our conversation. And Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hey there, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Why, thank you very much. I just commented to your screener that the minimum wage is, of course, is for the least prepared people that we have out there. And I mentioned to him, as somebody in construction, we get people who are coming to us supposedly for entry-level jobs who can't read a rule or can't add fractions, which is fourth-grade work. And as somebody who's been involved with apprenticeship training for the last 30 years, I can tell you categorically that these young people show up to us with fourth grade reading skills. So the real problem isn't the minimum wage. It's the minimum ability to do a job where somebody would be quite willing to pay a lot more than minimum wage, to get a job done. So I think we're looking at the wrong side of this. And also the impact of heightened minimum wage on high school kids who again aren't prepared. That's where they're like learning the ropes and learning what it's like to be in the real world. I think it's going to be a major impediment to them if this minimum wage law doesn't have a caveat that talks to that. So how about with a real high school diploma? That would be the criteria for that minimum wage.
Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Jim, I mean, we need an educated workforce. It's clear that there are definite holes in our system.
Yeah, and I think I don't disagree with any. I think we're talking about two different things here, though. And And he's absolutely right about the education remains a problem, and I've heard this from other people. But I think the only thing I would say about this is that the states that have increased the minimum wage, where they do pay, they seem to be doing economically better in terms of what people in those states are earning. The Economic Policy Institute in Washington did a major, major study on this last year. That indicated that where the minimum wage had gone up and in excess of the federal wage, and it's, I can't tell you the total number, but it's a dozen states at least, probably more. It's had a positive effect on the economies of those particular states. So I don't disagree with what Mike is saying, that I'm sure you run into those kinds of things, but I think where somebody does have some skills and some possibility, they need to be paid more because the numbers are really overwhelming. I mean, if median family income had kept pace over the last 25, 30 years since we originally wrote America, What Went Wrong, median family income would be around $70,000 today. Wow. In fact, it's around $62,000. So, I mean, this shows you, among other things, that for the majority of people, they're not able to keep up. And that doesn't even factor in their increased costs for their health care, for maybe what they're having to put away for retirement, if they even have enough money to put away for retirement. So it's a complicated issue, but the numbers are pretty stark, showing that people are not able to keep up.
I'm watching the clock here, and I do want to ask you about student debt, which I believe totals something like $1.6 trillion. I think about 40 million Americans are saddled with some form of student debt. Now, my understanding is that the average amount is something like $30,000, not an insignificant amount of money. And for people who owe more than $100,000 in student debt, that's about 6%. But nonetheless, what do we do about that? Because it obviously prevents people from buying a house or buying a car or making some kind of investment in their adult life.
Many solutions have been proposed, and one of which is just forgive it all, which is politically not feasible and not going to happen. Obviously, for those most in need, we ought to figure out a way to do that. And I think not only with what's happened so far, but how are we going to deal with this going forward? I mean, because all those issues are still going to be there. The $1.6 trillion today could be $3 trillion. In 10 years, unless we figure out a way to get more money to people to reduce that particular. So it's a twofold thing. It's dealing with what's out there and looking ahead. And in terms of what the debt we have now, one of the entities that makes a lot of money off this is the actual federal government itself. Some of the older debt is out there at higher interest rates than it should be. So it's a terribly complex issue, but it goes to the heart of our whole younger generation and a generation not so young, because it, as you point out, it affects your ability to buy a house, to really start a family, maybe even to start a business. All of those things are at the heart of that. So some of it needs to be forgiven for sure, and we need to figure out an approach to deal with the rest of it, and we have so far been unable to do that.
About 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye. You've been doing this work for decades now. Do you have hope for this country that we can solve these systemic problems?
We can solve these things, and we have as a nation done this in the past. And I've often thought about, if you think back to the Great Recession 2008 and what we're going through now, if we didn't have Social Security and Medicare, for example, and to a lesser extent Obamacare in the past, I mean, look how much worse this whole thing would have been in 2008. It would be like the Great Depression, and it would be very bad right now if those bits of the safety net weren't there. So we've done this in the past, and I think we can do it in the future. Part of it is people putting pressure on Washington, telling people what they want, and voting for the right people, and saying we need to make this a better country. And I think we have the capacity. So let's hope we can do it.
Well, Jim Steele, thank you for joining us once again on Radio Times. It's been a couple of years. Thanks for coming back.
Great to be with you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, co-author with Donald Barlett, America, What Went Wrong? The Crisis deepens. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those questions as well.